Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thanks very much for joining me again for this episode, in which, rather than discussing a particular film this week, I'm going to be talking about a book. It's Karina Longworth's book, which is called Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood. Which I believe was released towards the end of last year, but I've just got around to reading it. And a person who's also just recently read it is Raquel Stetcher, and she joins me today. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And it's nice to reteam for this, I think, because we've done, you know, a couple of podcasts sort of discussing books in one way or another, but we've always been doing quite general overviews, haven't we? So I guess it's kind of nice here to have the chance to zero in on one book in particular on this occasion.
Yeah, I agree. It's fun to do a deep dive on one subject.
Right, so Karina Longworth's written this book, and we'll sort of give our thoughts on the book in due course. But I just thought we could discuss her briefly. So, you know, she's someone who's written widely for a range of publications about film. I didn't realise, actually, she'd published several books before this one. I kind of thought this was her first book, but that's not the case. I don't know if you've read any of her other books, Raquel.
No, but I've had my eye on the Hollywood frame by frame for a long time. And now that I've read this one, I'll definitely pick that one up.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine a lot of people are likely, if they're familiar with this podcast, I imagine there's a very good chance they'll be familiar with her podcast, which is You Must Remember This, you know, about secret or lesser known stories from Hollywood history, which I'll confess is a podcast I really, really like. I'm a little bit behind. You know, I've got this backlog of episodes to work through, but I think it's fabulous. I mean, are you a fan of that podcast, Raquel?
Yeah, I started listening to it years ago, and I was trying to remember exactly when I started. It was probably around when she had started the Charles Manson series, the Charles Manson and Hollywood series. And I remember there was an episode just on Raquel Welch, and I was just so fascinated by it. It was a great podcast. And this, she had done themes and single topic episodes. But then when the Charles Manson series came out, that's when her podcast really kind of just became super popular. She was everywhere. And one of the great strengths of the podcast is her storytelling capabilities, her narrative style, but also the depth of research, just how much information she delivers in a very entertaining way. And it became so popular that people who are not necessarily classic movie fans, but are interested in Hollywood, would listen. And I think it's great because she is basically entertaining and informing audiences who may not have been watching classic movies, but are now more open to it.
Yeah, definitely. And perhaps in some ways, this book that she's written is perhaps an extension of that kind of work anyway. But I mean, in terms of You Must Remember This, I think I'm right in saying it's now on a break of some kind. I think she said she might return, or she hopes to return, but there's no sort of concrete plans at this stage. Is that right?
That is right. I think the last episode she did was on Ramon Navarro, and she said that she's taking a hiatus. The podcast was on the Panoply Network, but I was listening to some of her episodes that she did for the publication of this book. She did like a little series just on some of the actresses who are mentioned in Seduction. And it looks like it was picked up by Slate. So there's some advertising that's been added to it. So maybe that's a good sign that she got some more funding to do more episodes in the future.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully it'll be back one day. But at least, well, for me, I've got a chance to catch up. But yeah, if anyone's listening and hasn't checked out You Must Remember This in the past, it's well worth your time, in my opinion. Also, she's just written an article round about the time we're recording, actually, about a week or two ago. I think it was published for the Wall Street Journal, which was highlighting books about Hollywood. That's another thing people could check out. So this book is all about, well, Howard Hughes and the women he encounters. So just a quick word on Hughes before we get to the book specifically, you know, sort of our familiarity with him and his work, and also with Hughes from other media, somebody who's been parodied a lot, someone who's featured in other films, for instance. He's a very interesting, strange figure. He produced and directed a number of films from the 20s to the 50s. So in terms of his film work, not really a prolific figure, which is a point that very much comes through in the book. But, you know, notable films he directed, Hell's Angels and The Outlaw, people might know. And the films he produced would include stuff like Howard Hawks' Scarface, also Macau and The Conqueror. And some of us too. So yeah, what's your familiarity with either the films he's directed or produced?
So as somebody who loves to do research and loves to read about old movies, it's impossible not to come across his name. Yeah. Just for example, when we were talking about Out of the Past from 1947, some podcast episodes ago, just doing research on Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer, the two stars of the film, those careers were very much influenced by Howard Hughes in a positive way in Mitchum's case and a negative way in Greer's case. So when in my case, just doing any sort of research, it's you're going to come up against Howard Hughes's name. And there's some projects that he worked with, like The Conqueror or, like you said, The Outlaw and Hell's Angels, where maybe they're not the best films, but they made huge impacts on the industry, or they're notable in film history. And also, I mean, if anyone's ever seen The Aviator, Martin Scorsese's very glossy biopic, which has like the most amazing cast, Leonardo DiCaprio plays him, then you'll be familiar with the story. And that really goes into the neurosis of his life. But just a fun fact, something I had remembered this morning is that Elisha Cook Jr., who people will remember from classic movies, he played a Howard Hughes type character in an episode of Magnum PI that came out in 1981. He was Harold Farber, an eccentric millionaire recluse who was a total germaphobe. That's totally a Howard Hughes type. So he's been, parodied or depicted in many ways.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you use those words, you know, eccentric, reclusive, germaphobe, because that's what I was thinking. That I think I was trying to remember when I first heard Hughes' name or when I first became aware of him. And I think he's one of those figures I probably encountered through like cultural references, like jokes and, like I said, the parodies. So I remember an episode of The Simpsons where Mr. Burns becomes like a Howard Hughes type figure with long fingernails and that kind of thing.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Yeah, that might have been the first time I saw a Hughes type character on the screen. And then I also remembered in the James Bond film, Diamonds Are Forever, there's a character called Willard White, who's, again, he's a Texan reclusive billionaire type figure. So it's all these kind of portrayals I was thinking of. Then I think I began to pay a bit more attention to him around about the time, like you say, The Aviator, which I think is 2004. Which doesn't do the full kind of cradle to grave thing, but it kind of zeroes in at a particular point on his life. Recently, I don't know, did you see the Warren Beatty film Rules Don't Apply?
No.
I didn't see it either, because it seemed to come and go in cinemas in like a weekend. It kind of came and went. It sounds quite interesting. I think it had kind of mixed reviews.
Yes, I did hear that. Did that focused on his relationship with one of the actresses, correct? I'm trying to remember who it was.
Well, it had two young performers in it as well. It had, I think it was Lily Collins and Alden Ehrenreich. Let me just see. Wikipedia, let's see. The film follows the romantic relationship between a young actress and her driver, which is forbidden by their employer, Howard Hughes.
Oh, so that must have been like later in his career when he made a lot of promises to young potential starlets, but nothing ever kind of came out of it.
Yeah, this is it. It looks like it was set in 1958, so yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Anyway, I'd like to check that out, but as of yet, I haven't. Okay, so what about this book then? Well, I'll just say straight up, I really enjoyed the book, found it very engaging. I thought it was it sort of hit a nice balance between sort of hitting all the points you'd expect it to, as well as weaving in information that's perhaps less familiar. But yeah, in general terms and overall terms, what did you think?
I think if anyone is a fan of her podcast, You Must Remember This, they'll be pleased. They won't be surprised. They'll be pleased by this book because it delivers in the way her podcast delivers. Very well researched, lots of context, a lot of kind of salacious stories, titillating tales. It lures you in. I mean, the whole book is almost a seduction in itself in the way that it lures you into the stories.
Yeah.
I do really like that she provides a lot of context in terms of not only is it a story about Howard Hughes and all these actresses that he has influenced, but there's also lots of stories about other people who inhabited his world. So you get lots of different aspects of the story. And one thing that is really great in terms of Howard Hughes as a subject is it teaches you a lot about film history because he was a disruptor of the industry. He disrupted in so many different ways, whether it was pushing against the code or how things were done or how a producer worked or how RKO was run, like anything that he did kind of went against the grain. And it's kind of a nice way to learn about how the industry worked. So she picked a very good subject. Just one other thing too is, even if you're not interested in film history, this is just enjoyable as is, which is kind of rare among film books, because mostly books about the industry, you're gonna want to be interested in the subject matter. This is just, it's almost, you can almost read it like a novel. It's so entertaining in that aspect as well. So that's the strength of it.
Yeah, well, this is what I was wondering going into it, was like, will this be a book that will appeal mainly to other cinephiles, film fans, or will it be more satisfying for general readers too? And I think it will be, because, well, I think some level of interest in the subject matter obviously will be helpful, but like you say, one thing the book really does well is it uses, like, Hughes, you know, the stories about him and these women, of course, but also these broader industrial changes and developments. So like you say, the application of the production code, the coming of sound, you know, the decline of the studio system, for example. You find out about all of these things. So yeah, in other words, I think a non-cinephile reader or just a more casual film fan who takes a look at this would definitely find themselves very enriched in terms of their knowledge, not just about Hughes and everybody else involved, but Hollywood in general. So yeah, I think it does that really well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and one of the things I like to call these kind of books life and times books, because it's not a straight biography from, I mean, you do follow his story from very beginning to very end and even after, but there's so many other stories woven in that, yeah, you really get a sense of that world. And there's almost, in a way, like a good science fiction or fantasy would do, there's some world building, and this is not something that we have access to other than learning about it through documentaries or films. But if you're a stranger to old Hollywood, she does enough world building so you kind of understand the glamour and the drama of the whole era.
Yeah, most definitely. But I will confess that when this book arrived, when the package arrived, and it was enormous, my heart sank a little, not because I don't like long books or anything, just that, you know, it's finding the time and all that kind of thing. So over 850 pages, if you include the notes at the back of the book.
That's interesting, because my book is 500 pages, but it could be how it's set up in terms of like font size. And you probably have a UK edition. I have a hardcover US edition.
Ah, we've got different versions. That's interesting. So, yeah, this one, the print is quite large. So actually, once I started reading it, I found I was absolutely flying through it. So I went from like my heart sinking to actually quite a nice feeling of achievement that, wow, I'm flying through this book. I'm getting through it really fast.
But it is very long, as you say, and it might be off-putting to somebody who's either pressed for time or somebody who doesn't read longer books, who reads maybe more shorter books, or is used to reading research articles and things like that, or is more of a fan of podcasts, because it's so easy to listen to Karina Longworth's podcast on your commute to work or something like that. So, but one thing too is like each section almost breaks off like its own book too. So it's like you're reading, how many parts are there? Like six parts? Like you're reading six different books.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of the scope of it, perhaps it sort of has to be this expansive, because the focus is not just on Hughes, of course, but also the actresses and the people he encounters. So I wasn't quite sure what to expect going into this. I'd heard some talk, or, you know, I think I'd read something that it focused on the women in Hughes's life. So I didn't know if that meant Hughes himself was going to be kind of sidelined in the book, but not really, as it turns out. So do you think it manages to balance well between being a tale about Hughes and about all these other people too?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. The biggest figures, I think there's plenty of time devoted to them. People like Jane Russell or Katharine Hepburn or Jean Peters. But I was surprised some of the other people, like Jane Greer was very briefly mentioned. Mm-hmm. Howard Hughes had an enormous impact on her career, or the fact that her career basically stalled and sputtered because of him. Even somebody like Gina Lollobrigida, who is someone I'm fascinated with, very little about her in this too.
Yeah.
But one thing which was interesting about the little series she did on her podcast that was a companion piece to this is she picked three different actresses. She picked Anne Dvorak, Linda Darnell, and Gina Lollobrigida to focus on more closely. I'm hoping I'm remembering that those it was those three. So she expanded on those three actresses with those episodes. So if you, for anyone who does read this book, it's worth going to those episodes to get a little more about women who were maybe glossed over a little bit.
Yeah. So what do you think about sort of the general approach though? I mean, I suppose the thing is that one of the byproducts of the focus on Hughes in pop culture, you know, like we say, is this odd figure, the reclusive billionaire germaphobe. I think maybe that perhaps, or maybe it's inadvertently, maybe it's not, but it downplays the very real effect, you know, often extremely negative, that he had on lots of other people's lives by centering him, you know, as the main man. So I think I felt this was absolutely valid and really welcome, actually, to write about Hughes in this way, whilst also highlighting the lives and experiences of the women he encountered. I mean, lots of people who are especially interested in old Hollywood will know about the less savoury side of Hughes, I think. But still, yeah, I think a welcome approach, even if, like you say, there are some figures who don't get as much attention as the others.
I mean, there's so much about his story. He had his hands in so many different industries between, you know, the oil industries with the drills and the Hughes tool and the aviation career, TWA, and then the whole thing with the government. And then he became a hermit at the end of his life, and then the whole scandal after. There's so many aspects of his career. So I did like that she focused just on the Hollywood aspect. Because, yeah, this could have been easily a 1,500-page book on Howard Hughes and all the things that were going on in his life, because he had so many things going on pretty much every single year of his life. Even if he wasn't working in Hollywood at the time, he would have other projects.
Yeah, most definitely. And in terms of, like you say, it could have been an even more expansive book. And that's sort of reinforced by the point Longworth makes when she writes about the sort of research she did.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
It was, wasn't it? Because she talks about, you know, visiting the Howard Hughes files at the Texas State Archives in Austin, for instance. I think she said she was there for 10 days, but she was only able to kind of scratch the surface of the thousands or tens of thousands of documents that are held there. But nevertheless, you know, it seems to me that the book is massively like enriched by the materials she was able to look at and draw upon. So things like the call logs between Hughes and his aides, and also some of the other archive materials from the, you know, collections about some of the women involved were fascinating too, I thought.
That's one of my favorite aspects of reading a classic film book is going to the acknowledgement section and seeing where they did their research. And I like that she does a whole notes on sources and really describes how she got the materials that she did. And it really gives you some context of like exactly how much work goes into this. There's so much information. The fact that she just spent 10 days in Texas looking through his documents, but could only do so much and still got so much information is amazing.
Yeah, it's quite tantalizing though, isn't it? Like what else is there left to unearth in those archives? But maybe that's the story for another day.
Yeah.
So I thought we could speak, more specifically about some of the book's content. I mean, rather than do a chapter by chapter breakdown now, I thought we could just kind of touch on each of the main six sections that the book is divided into. Just to give a flavor, I suppose. So hopefully people are still listening who haven't read the book. So I guess we'll get a little bit more specific, but general listeners, you're safe to stay with us, hopefully. But the book starts with part one, which is Hollywood before Hell's Angels, 1910 to 1928. So I felt this section set the scene very nicely, because what it does first of all, doesn't it, is set up the idea of Hollywood as this kind of debauched place. And then in terms of like a specific sense of place, you know, we read about things like the Ambassador Hotel and the Coconut Grove. So first of all, it kind of set the scene well.
It did. It's probably, to use a PG term, the sexiest way to get into a story is that introduction, which was very salacious but enticing and totally on brand for her and really draws you into this crazy world of Howard Hughes. So I thought that was very effective as an introduction.
And also what this section really does is drives home like the way Hollywood at that time especially would just chew up and spit out young women, wouldn't it, who, you know, few of them would find the success they craved, but many of whom along the way would be massively exploited. And what also comes across, I think, in this part of the book is the point that, you know, at this time, the general public would have been largely ignorant of all of this too, which I thought was fascinating.
It's really interesting how she drives home at the very beginning the gender politics of the time and how these men were using these women in power moves to basically make money in this industry, especially during the Great Depression, where it was very hard to make money. But also interesting how there were, like, how they built personas and how Howard Hughes himself built a persona. So from the beginning, we start to get not only this really kind of interesting story, but also a lot of like deep kind of philosophical thoughts about what was going on at this time in the industry.
Yeah, and just stepping back a second. So, like you say, philosophical thoughts. But do you think that does that kind of thing ever give you pause as a classic film fan? The fact that so many people were exploited and treated really badly at this point in history. How do we kind of reconcile it? Do you know what I mean? It's quite tough sometimes when you know there are all these scandals and people treated so terribly, but you kind of have to approach it as an art form too. It's kind of strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I have to say, anytime I encounter Howard Hughes's name in my research before I read this book, always was kind of a downer because he was always presented as somebody who was manipulating a woman's career, which is just really sad because these women, in several cases, talks about them being career women who really wanted to do something with their acting, with their presence and their fame, but were held back. So yeah, it is, as somebody living today, somebody like myself who considers herself a feminist, it's depressing.
Yeah, and I guess in some then, so part one, after it sort of sets the scene, it also moves on to discuss Hughes's family and Hughes himself as a young man. Going on to like the early stages of production on Hell's Angels, which is a fascinating tale. Also, his first marriage of many, I think, and his first wife was Ella Rice, wasn't it? So, yeah, we get the sense of young Howard, don't we, at the outset of the book.
I think that was one of the most fascinating stories. Just learning about how his mother influenced him and in terms of his how he developed that kind of phobia with germs and obsession with cleanliness, and also with his father and the business aspect of it, how his dad had taught him how to take complete control over the business, take control over all the profits. That those influences absolutely guided his life and career. So that gave me so much context, and I had a lot of aha moments when I was reading that. So it was fascinating.
Yeah, and that issue of complete control factors into like his filmmaking as well. And part of me respects the kind of single-mindedness, you know, let's sit around for months waiting for the clouds to be in the right place. But also, what a nightmare it must have been for the people working with Hughes.
Absolutely.
Okay, so part two of the book is entitled Billy and Jean, 1928 to 1936. So who are Billy and Jean? Well, Billy is Billy Dove, who Longworth describes as being, at one time, the most objectified American actress in movies. Someone who supposedly was receiving 37,000 fan letters a month by the end of the silent era, which is pretty incredible. And the book tells us about Dove's relationship with Hughes, which began while both were married to other people. So for me, I was only kind of passingly familiar with Billy Dove, so I enjoyed learning more about her. So what did you make of the way the book discussed her?
I thought it was interesting, her collaboration with Lois Weber and how she went from this kind of very fruitful collaboration with another woman in the industry to her working with Howard Hughes. And there's this great line in the book where the author says that basically he took an asset who wasn't fully used to her total capacity and ran her fame into the ground. Like, he completely destroyed her career. And I was like, wow, it's amazing how one person can have an influence. So especially someone in power like he was on somebody else's career. And also just the fact that they were in this romantic relationship, and you kind of start to get a sense in how he treated romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. And this kind of sets the tone for the future ones that will come later in the book.
Yes, indeed. And like you say, this kind of destructive influence he has, but it could also be constructive as well, couldn't it? Mm-hmm. So I guess that applies in the case of Gene, which is Gene Harlow.
Right.
Who arrived in Hollywood in 1923 as a 12-year-old before eventually, of course, becoming a legendary figure. And so the book discusses like Harlow's style, doesn't it? You know, that she's, you know, the platinum blonde and so on. And I think Longworth makes the point that her style was particularly suited to the Depression era, you know, on-screen glamour at a time of like wider hardship. And Hughes was involved in the construction of Harlow's style. But there's also a very uncomfortable aspect to this too. You know, the focus on like Hughes's focus on breasts, you know, not just Harlow's, but other women's too, is kind of a very unsettling through line through the book, isn't it? A very eccentric, unsavory thing.
Yeah, I think out of all of these stories in terms of focusing on the women that he worked with, maybe Jean Harlow was the most interesting. And I think Longworth very much makes some very interesting observations that I hadn't thought about before in terms of Jean Harlow with her approach to her sexuality on screen and how that differed from her own personal sexuality too. And there was this great line where the author says that Harlow was sexy enough to manipulate men, but not threatening enough for women. And they still, she was able to appeal to both men and women, which was a strength in terms of how she presented herself. Like she could be in a film like Red Dust and be in the middle of the jungle, but still be glamorous, even in this kind of environment, which is not glamorous. I mean, she was able to take like two different aspects of her self and present them. So in terms of it, that was really fascinating.
I'll tell you one thing I always think when I read about old Hollywood, I think, and it definitely applies to this book too, but just the sense of like wasted potential that comes through.
Yeah.
And it definitely applies to Jean Harlow, just in terms of these people who you look at the dates when, you know, of the ages some people were when they died in old Hollywood. And there were lots of people who died before their time. So you get the, it's a very sad aspect of this book, I think, you know, Jean Harlow's decline and ultimately her death in 1937. But do you know what I mean? It definitely seems to be something you have to kind of be prepared to read about in terms of old Hollywood, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, just how she was treated by her mother and her stepfather, and how she was treated by her various love interests, and how Hughes had a huge control over her her career in terms of, like, he would only pay her $200 a week, even though some of her films were grossing quite amazing numbers during a time where, you know, during the Great Depression, which was not easy. It is very tragic what happened to her, for sure.
Okay, so the book, the third section of the book, part three, is called Hepburn and Rogers and Russell, 1932 to 1940. So obviously, Katharine Hepburn, Ginger Rogers, and Jane Russell. So Hepburn's relationship with Hughes is described as non-traditional and as being key to his lasting legacy as a romantic hero. Just in terms of Ginger Rogers, the book discusses Hughes's romance with her and their subsequent breakup. That's what I thought was interesting, actually, is that, you know, you get this scene where, so Rogers standing her ground and leaving Hughes after she realizes about his manipulative ways. And it's an event which is said to have proved unusually emotional for Hughes, isn't it? I think his aide, Noah Dietrich, is quoted as saying it's the only time anyone saw him cry. So we do get these, this vulnerability to Hughes does come through as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think later on in the book too, it said that he only loved only a few women in his life, and Ginger Rogers was mentioned. Even though he had so many relationships, there's something about her. Maybe she's the one that got away, and he was never able to really finish that in his mind, or he didn't have control the way he usually has control, and he kind of lost it with Ginger Rogers.
Yeah, so Jane Russell also enters the picture in this section of the book. So she's cast by Hughes in The Outlaw. And it's like you sort of, we've alluded to, with Hughes being this provocative figure, so The Outlaw falling afoul of the censors because of its shocking emphasis for the time, certainly, on Jane Russell's body. Yeah, so what did you make of this section, and Hepburn and Rogers and Russell overall? It seemed like Hughes, in some ways, he takes a back seat to these women through this part of the book.
I thought the Hepburn one part of it was very interesting. Just even coming off a film like The Aviator, where Kate Blanchett plays Katharine Hepburn, and so much of their relationship is explored in that movie. What I thought was interesting that I got a little more from the book is the fact that they were very similar. They're both people who didn't fit a particular mold. They were eccentric. They just didn't follow Hollywood's rules of what a woman actress or, you know, a Hollywood mogul should be. And I think that kind of drew them together. I thought that that whole relationship was interesting. I had no clue that Howard Hughes bankrolled The Philadelphia Story, which is famously known as the film that rescued Katharine Hepburn's career after she was labeled box office poison. So that was a super interesting fact about her. And then with Jane Russell, Jane Russell's always been an interesting figure because I've listened to an interview with her kind of later in her life. She was interviewed by Robert Osborne alongside with Robert Mitchum. They had reunited them. And they both spoke very highly of Howard Hughes. But Howard Hughes had a very interesting effect on Jane Russell's career, from how everything happened with the Outlaw and the invention of a, you know, brand new bra that she didn't end up using. I thought that was super interesting. And how he pushed back against the code and the Breen's office in terms, I mean, that's one of the positive aspects of Hughes' career, is the fact that he was against the censorship and really fought against it. And the Outlaw is kind of like a first crack in the shell that kind of, you know, sets a course for the future. But Jane Russell kind of, she plays into it, but she also fights against it. But she was more like a collaborator with Hughes in a way. I don't know, what did you get from that?
Yeah, I liked the sense the book gave of Russell. You know, it's quite a rounded figure, you know, so it sort of makes the point that, you know, she'll participate in these photo shoots and things where she's bouncing on the bed and she looks, you know, happy to go along with it up to a certain point. But then she would also withstand the ground at times. In terms of the Outlaw, I agree with what you're saying. And it's dramatized quite amusingly in The Aviator, isn't it? Where Hughes gets a scientist played by Ian Holm to conduct his presentation about women's cleavages and things like that. I agree. I think there's a value to someone like him as a kind of provocative figure. I guess the other thing that comes through in this section is, you know, his experiences as an aviator factor into this part of the book, I think. So his efforts to circumnavigate the globe, for instance. So I guess you can understand why Hughes, like we say, he was always an odd figure, and increasingly so as the years went on. But he seemed, you know, I can understand why he seemed quite appealing at this point in time, for instance. I think the book makes the point quite well that he was an admirable figure in some respects.
He was quite fearless. I mean, he circumnavigated the globe after Amelia Earhart went missing. That's pretty bold. I mean, that, like, knowing that death might come your way, but still going for it. Like, he just tried everything. He was not scared to try something. He wasn't scared to push back. I mean, there were definitely aspects of his personality which were not very good, like maybe some of the racism that's hinted at in the book or described a little bit, and also his controlling nature. But yeah, like the fact that he opened up the possibility of a huge production with Hell's Angels, or he pushed against the production code with The Outlaw. He wasn't scared to do things differently, even when he had these outside voices telling him, don't do that, that's too expensive, that's not how things are done. He was just totally a disruptor.
Yeah, a very paradoxical figure, really, when you think, you know, like say, fearless and intrepid and an adventurer, but also someone who becomes this recluse. It's fascinating, actually. All right, so part four is called Life During Wartime, 1941 to 1946. In terms of the women who enter this section of the book, so I guess we've got Faith Domergue. How do you pronounce her surname, Raquel? I always stumble over that one.
That was a flaw in the book, I thought, because earlier on it said Domergue, but then later on it said Domergue. So I've always heard it pronounced Faith Domergue, so I'll go with that, I guess.
All right, I'll defer to that. So Domergue sounds good to me. So she enters the book, as does Ava Gardner. So Domergue's relationship with Howard Hughes is described as this like roller coaster of emotion, notable for its strange, like, paternal element, is the impression that comes across. In terms of Gardner, her marriage with Mickey Rooney is covered, which was unpopular with the studio and ultimately falls apart before too long, and then she gets into a relationship with Hughes. It's kind of in parallel, isn't it? He effectively trapped Faith Demerg with a dramatic incident then occurring when she rams Hughes' car one night when she sees him out with Ava. Yeah, all that's going on. Also, the furore over the outlaw continues into this part of the book, but the film ultimately breaks box office records. So what were your main sort of takeaways from part four?
So this happens to be my least favorite part of the book, I have to say, and I enjoyed the book overall. Yeah. I thought the whole foray into Ava Gardner's relationship with Mickey Rooney, there's some interesting aspects to that in terms of how she kind of sets the context with the fact that he's like a major MGM star. Ava Gardner's starting her career. It's World War II. I mean, there's all these factors going into the relationship, but I thought it was maybe more salacious than it needed to be. There was some stuff like I didn't really need to know. And the Faith Demerg story was interesting. I had no clue. I mean, she's not one of my favorite actresses. I didn't think she was that good of an actress. Yeah. But the fact that he really impeded her career and Ava Gardner held her ground more and was able to fight back, whereas Faith Demerg was, she was more controlled by Howard Hughes in a negative way, which is sad. And there was one little piece where Faith Demerg goes to a party with my favorite actress, Susan Peters, which I thought that was a nice little nugget. Although Karina Longworth got Susan Peters' real name, Suzanne Carnahan, incorrect in the book. I think she just put Susan Carnahan. That was a little, there's a couple minor errors I discovered. But yeah, this was, I don't know if it was more the storylines with Faith Demerg and Ava Gardner that I didn't like as much. Maybe they were just frustrating, or how they were delivered wasn't my favorite. I don't know.
Yeah, well, let me follow up on that point, because I was wondering this. In terms of, you mentioned salaciousness, and I was thinking about this in relation to some of the stuff relating to Terry Moore or Terry Hughes later in the book. But I think it applies here too. But is there a sense that the book is repeating stuff that is unnecessary, or is it necessary to get all the context of the scandal and the gossip and so on? And when it came to the end of the book, I was less sure whether it was justified. But I think it also applies, like you say, there's some stuff about Ava Gardner, you know, some choice quotes, some references to her sex life, essentially. And yeah, I don't know if I'd say I was uncomfortable, but I did wonder about this.
There were a few points, especially with the Ava Gardner part, where I thought it went further than it needed to.
Yeah.
But I kept thinking, okay, remember how it's like on You Must Remember This? It's the exact same way there. You're going to get these salacious, provocative stories about Hollywood's kind of forbidden history, I think is how she labels it. So it fits her brand. And I think these salacious stories are what will intrigue people who are not interested in film history or about coming here for the interesting stories. But I did feel it went, especially in this section, a little too far, and I learned a little too much that I didn't need to know. There is a fine line between knowing some things and not, and
yeah,
and there's also like, there's a point earlier in the book where she discusses how sexuality, especially when it comes to somebody's homosexuality, somebody who wasn't out in their lifetime, and delving into that. And she said, and the author says something about how it robs the stars of their agency. And I thought, well, that can also apply to some of the more secret aspects of their sex lives too, that we don't necessarily need to know.
Yeah, I might return to this point when we come to the final section of the book, because I think it is fascinating. In terms of, like, this is wartime, so Hughes had been awarded this huge defense contract in 1943, but he was unable to deliver on his schedule. You know, not surprisingly, when you consider the way he worked in terms of filmmaking, I suppose. It's kind of a pivotal time for him. Suffers a bad plane crash during this period, investigated by Congress for his use of government funds. But it seems to be, you know, he has this miraculous recovery from his injuries, and that it's around this time maybe this mythological folklore kind of builds up around him. He's this new American hero or something. And I think that's an important thing for people, well, you know, like us in the present day, to remember that his image and his reputation was something that shifted back and forth and quite considerably over time. He wasn't always the recluse. So I thought that at least that came across well in the book.
Yeah, no, this is definitely a pivotal time in his life. And there's so much more going on than just the film stuff. So in that aspect, it was really interesting. And also, when I watched The Aviator recently, after reading the book, a lot of what's featured in that movie is from this era, like you said earlier, especially like the way that they filmed the plane crash, which is a very horrific event in his life. And the fact that he survived multiple plane crashes kind of speaks to, like, as I said earlier, his fearlessness. But also, yeah, this is just like it was a crazy time in his life.
Yeah, I did the same. I watched The Aviator a few nights ago, and so the Congress investigation features heavily in the film, doesn't it?
Yes.
With Alan Alda's kind of the antagonist there. The other thing that comes through in this book is, well, this is also at the time when Hughes buys RKO, which carries on into part five, his time there. Also, this entourage he has around him, the people like Pat DiCicco, who would help him meet women, just seems like a very, very weird system. You know, governed by these unwritten rules. So if Hughes comes over and talks to a woman, that's it. None of his assistants could, you know, show any interest or attention to her from that point on. And then at other points in the book, we realize, don't we, that he's having not just the women in his life followed, also having the people following the women followed. Kind of an insurance policy on, you know, on making sure his staff are behaving correctly as he sees it. It's just so bizarre, isn't it?
It's very strange. Yeah, this is where you start to learn some of the peculiar aspects of his personality and his, like, what Karina Longworth calls, like, his undisclosed mental, undiagnosed mental condition. Like, we don't know exactly what was going on here.
Okay, so part five is Terry, Gene, and RKO, 1948 to 1956. It's actually the longest section of the book, I believe, in terms of page count. Terry is Terry Moore, an actress whose naive quality apparently attracted Hughes, as she herself indicated or suggested. Another paternal relationship, it seems. Hughes repeatedly proposing to Moore, the pair eventually getting married on a boat that had sailed out into international waters. So there's this strange thing where, is the marriage legal? Did it really happen? You know?
Yeah.
In any case, it didn't last, but that becomes a factor later in his life, doesn't it?
Yeah, that I have to say, I had a hard time keeping up with that story. There's so many twists and turns and how it all comes out at the end. I was just like, I kept saying, wow, like several times during this.
Well, some of it is like, if it was fiction, you'd say it was too far-fetched, isn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, and this is definitely one of those cases.
Yeah, and in the case of Terry Moore, so the marriage, as it were, didn't last, but she remarries. Like you say, it's quite hard to keep up. She remarries, then she begins a new affair with Hughes and comes back into his fold. So it's quite complicated.
And she marries Jean Peters' ex-husband.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is like, that's very, yeah, I made actually a little map of that just so I can keep track of the names and how things were being connected, because I started getting lost a little bit.
Yeah, no, I felt the same way. I didn't make a map, but that's a good idea, I think. And Jean Peters, so star of such films as Pick Up on South Street, to give one example, who dates Hughes. Sounds like they were non-exclusive for some time.
Mm-hmm.
She gets married to another man, subsequently divorced. I think I've got that right. Meanwhile, just the work in terms of films, so the work done at RKO at this time sounds quite odd, doesn't it? Lots of people on contract, but Hughes just continually like dithering over projects, production slowing to a crawl, and I think he eventually agrees a deal to sell RKO in 1955 or so.
To a tire company.
Yeah, it's just strange, isn't it? So there's lots going on, like we say, lots going on the romantic side, the personal side, and not so much going on with his career at this point in time, I guess.
I have to say, I mean, this focuses a lot on Terry Moore and Gene Peters, but I felt like I was more interested in the RKO aspect of it. Yeah. And I have to say, the Ida Lupino story was super fascinating to me, just in how she transitioned from actress to director and how she used her status as a woman to hold on to that. Like she played like a mother role so that the actors, the male actors, wouldn't feel threatened by her, and her crew wouldn't feel threatened by her, and how she kind of collaborated with Hughes how she runs the set like a family. I thought that was super interesting. And then it was interesting to learn how they kind of parted ways after The Hitchhiker, and then she makes The Bigamist after. That made me really curious. Ida Lupino's always somebody who I've been fascinated with, but haven't really had a chance to do a deep dive. This book, like, I already have a queue of films and some articles I'm going to read after this, because I want to do a deep dive into her career. If anything I got from this book is the fact that Ida Lupino is somebody to explore and somebody to appreciate, because just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because the book I read before this one, I read a book about Christine Becker wrote a book about Hollywood film stars in the 1950s who moved or appeared on American television during that decade. Mm-hmm. And there's a long section on Ida Lupino because she starred in a sitcom, which I think was called, I want to say, Mr. Adams and Eve. But it sounded like a fascinating series. It kind of used her in quite a shrewd way. And she just seems like a very canny figure, doesn't she? Someone who... She seems to play the game quite effectively, but also get what she wants in terms of her direction and things like that.
Yeah, she used the system to her behalf, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah. So there are also passages in this section on, like I say, Lupino, but Ingrid Bergman. I think this is the section where Robert Mitchum's work for Hughes comes up and others. So there's quite a lot going on. Do you think it got kind of too busy or not?
This is where I was taking the most notes just to keep track of everything. So I did get a little lost here, where the previous section about life during wartime maybe was the least interesting to me. This one was maybe the most difficult to follow in terms of all the threads that were going on. There were so many things. One thing that I did not even realize is Howard Hughes' involvement in The Conqueror, which is a famous film known for being shot in the desert in Utah over a radioactive site. And then so many of the stars, and then the director, Dick Powell, stars John Wayne, Susan Hayward, they all died of cancer from being exposed. And I had no clue that he had been involved in this project. So I was like, wow, there's another film that made a huge impact, but in a negative way. And he was involved with it in some capacity. Not blaming him for that, but you know.
Yeah. Well, this is The Conqueror, infamously John Wayne as Genghis Khan, isn't it?
Yes. It's a problematic film. And then it's got this really tragic after story. So of course that would be part of Hughes' story. And also the whole bit about the Barefoot Contessa and how he was involved in the editing of that story because he was a little too close to home.
That's right, yeah.
That makes me want to revisit that movie.
Yeah, because whenever I saw that, I was oblivious to these associations and connotations within it. So yeah, I feel the same way. What did you make of the passages on specific films in the book? So like there's a couple of pages on Macau, for instance, you know, like a close reading of the film. This is where I was wondering, maybe general readers might find those passages a little bit more skippable, perhaps, but they're quite brief, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going to edit this book down, maybe especially when it goes into the whole plot of the movie.
Yeah,
I think that stuff can be cut out because it's interesting for us because we're interested in classic movies. But for somebody who's maybe just here for the fun stories, it might not be as interesting. And also, I'm never a fan of plot summaries in general. So. Yeah. I don't necessarily care for those in books.
Yeah, no, I felt they were a bit more kind of dispensable, I suppose. But yeah. Like I said, they weren't overly long, I don't think.
No, and there weren't a lot of them. There were a lot of films that were discussed at length, but with no plot summary, mostly about the production or things going on behind the scenes, which to me is more interesting.
Part 6 of the book, then, is Hughes after RKO, so it's all about latter stages of Hughes' life, and it's kind of the Hughes that's fixed in the popular memory then, perhaps. So he gets more and more difficult to communicate with, more reclusive, more paranoid, it seems. He's still collecting, quote-unquote, young women under contract, despite no longer owning RKO.
That's crazy.
Yeah, very, very crazy. He's increasingly xenophobic and germophobic. So there's a story, isn't there, about how he... If he wanted to read a magazine, he would ask for free copies of the same magazine so that he could read the middle one without touching it or something, so it wouldn't be tainted.
Yeah. That was a great line.
Yeah. He's getting very erratic. So Jean Peters at this point is now his wife, I think. Mm-hmm. But he's accompanied by her far less frequently. He retreats into screening rooms at this point, you know, during this time. He'd watch films repeatedly, going days without sleep on occasion. It just scratches the surface what I've just said, really. Some of the details really are incredible. But of course, he dies eventually. He dies on a plane journey from Acapulco to Houston in 1976. So I guess this goes back to the point, like I say, of if this was fiction, you almost wouldn't believe it. But yeah, what did you make of this section of the book then? Hughes in his, yeah, Hughes's decline, I suppose.
This is the most erratic, most the craziest section of his story arc, because it's just how many things are going on at this aspect of his life. It's, I mean, just the line about how it took him 8 hours to eat a can of soup, or just so you can really see how his desire for complete control in his life, like how things are unraveling and how he's trying to get more and more control, but it's harder and harder to do. And he starts to lose really important connections in his life. Like, for example, he had a falling out with Noah Dietrich, who was his, like, right-hand man throughout his career. And then Noah Dietrich goes on to write his own biography on Hughes. And I thought it was interesting how in the book it said that Noah Dietrich kind of, like, I forget exactly what it said, but I thought he passed away. And it was just really that they had a falling out. Mm. So that was maybe a line that could have been said a little differently, because I had to actually look that, I had to Google that just to make sure I could follow along. And something that was fascinating too is the fact that he bought KLAS, the television station, and just so he could control what movies they showed at night. And he would call 15 minutes before one movie had before it had finished to tell them what to play next. I was like, wow, that is such a power move, and also speaks to that controlling nature of his personality.
Yeah, and it's things like that that I don't want to use the word endearing, because I don't think that's right, but I can sort of relate to that kind of thing. And, you know, screening films all night, yep, love it. I'd do that if I could.
Well, one thing that's fascinating about stories like this is not everyone can handle fame.
Yeah.
And not anyone can handle the power that comes with having a lot of money. So it's interesting to see when people don't handle that well, how that manifests in terms of their personality, how that exaggerates certain things that could have been under control or could have been dealt with had they not had that power.
It's just sad. It's sad as well, isn't it? I actually felt sort of like towards the end of his life, he's getting these injuries, but he doesn't get the necessary medical attention, really. He doesn't want to, you know, he ends up not walking again towards the end of his life, for instance. He doesn't, travels a bit, but, you know, spends a long, long time sequestered in his residences or whatnot. So I think there is a bit of poignancy to this side of his life, isn't there? For all his flaws, I still felt that came through.
I think one of the strengths of Longworth's book is the fact that she paints the portrait of a man. So you see all these aspects of his personality, his life, his career. So you get like he's not either good, wholly good or wholly bad. He's a mix, like we all are. We're all a mix of things. So there's a lot of humanity in the way that she presents him, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I think so too. And the book, of course, goes beyond the end of his life. So in the epilogue, Terry Moore comes back on the scene. So she now discusses their marriage ceremony in public, which it hadn't been before, which has the effect of, it puts a bit of a wrench in the legal works with respect to Hughes's will and so on. And this is what I was referring to earlier, I think. So she wrote two books about Hughes. The second one, By the Sounds of Things, it recounts in quite explicit detail some of Hughes's sexual encounters in what sounds like a very implausible manner. You know, it sounds like she'd been made aware of details that you just kind of think it would have been unlikely that Hughes would have shared these details with her in that fashion. Anyway, she eventually gets a settlement. So, yeah, a strange end to the story. But, you know, I guess it's kind of par for the course.
One of the most bizarre stories I've ever read is that whole tale of how she, you know, how she came out about being his wife and just all the details that went into those court cases and the settlement and the publicity she did and what, like, how she was announcing that she was going to fly around the world on her own and she was going to write these books and all the... It's very, very strange. And I didn't really know much about her, but yeah, I think she's still around too. I think she's still with us, which it's interesting because a lot of the figures in this book have passed on since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, wow. Well, like one of the most bizarre Hollywood stories. And I've read a lot of Hollywood stories.
Well, she even becomes this celebrity, you know, poses for Playboy, I think, and things like this. So she gets this public profile. Yeah, strange end to the story. But I guess in summation, so as we've said, I think this book is well worth it. Maybe not perfect, but very compulsive, very readable. I'm confident that the people, you know, listening to a podcast like this would enjoy it, certainly. Was there anything else you wanted to mention about this book, Raquel, or any final thoughts you wanted to offer?
I would say, if you're at all interested in Gina Lollobrigida's career, she's briefly mentioned in the book, but Karina Longworth did a podcast episode just on her career, and it's one of the best episodes that I have listened of, like the many podcast episodes that I have heard of hers. And it's a great companion piece to this book. So I definitely recommend if anyone's interested in Gina Lollobrigida and wants to know more about her career and how Howard Hughes affected her career, that I highly recommend that as kind of like a supplemental material, basically.
Yeah, great stuff. So also, if anyone listening has either read this book or goes away and reads this book off the back of listening to us today, let us know what you think. It'd be great to hear what other people make of this too. All right, Raquel, so in the meantime, where can people find you online if they want to check out what else you're up to?
So if you like classic movies, I have a blog called Out of the Past, outoftheplastblog.com. It also has a YouTube channel, and I'm starting to make more videos on there just about classic movies. I'm on Twitter. That's my favorite social media platform, which is just at Raquel Stetcher. And I review new movies at kelmovies.com.
All right. So yeah, thanks listeners for joining us today. We'll be back very soon. So I hope you can join us next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.